Today is June 7th, 2018, and my name is Deborah Schwartz, and I'm here on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Public Library. Very, very happy to be sitting here today in the sound booth at the Mill Valley Public Library with John Bodiger.
Yes.
John, you're a psychologist.
Yes.
You're a professor, you're a writer, you're a blogger, you're a group leader, and you happen to be the grandson of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yes, all of that.
All of that and much more, I'm sure. Thank you so much for giving me your time and sharing your story with the Historical Society and the library.
Happy to.
I was looking at your blog this morning, as a matter of fact, preparing for this interview, and you write about justice and hope and history, so inevitably these are issues of meaning and value, good and evil, sacred and profane, body, mind, heart, and soul as one integrated systematic whole, the evolution of human consciousness through a lifetime and from one generation to another to the seventh generation, and the character and health of our relationships with each other, our roots in family, community, and place, and our membership in the natural world, of which we are an interactive part and for which we bear unique responsibility.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you.
I haven't changed that language in 25 years.
That just looked like the ultimate interview to me. Those beautiful words that embody so much, really just everything on so many levels. So I'm really excited to have this time to talk with you. And I doubt we're even going to be able to just get even a little bit through all these issues, but I'll be happy for what we can.
Great.
Let us start with just a little context information. Let's start with your family history, because this is a history interview.
Sure.
So can you go, I mean, you really have a lot of family history. Of anybody I've interviewed, you really probably have some of the most known family history. Gee whiz, there was just, I watched the Ken Burns documentary.
Oh, yes.
Did you watch?
Of the family, of course.
Yes, and but let's take it from your perspective. Tell me a little bit about your family and go back as far as you can. Just, it doesn't have to be a lot, but just a little bit to help us understand who preceded you and how you came to be.
Well, I'd have to go back to Nicholas von Rosenfeld, who with his wife, I'm not sure how she pronounced it, Janet, essentially, both Dutch, probably burgers, with an H, not ham, who emigrated from a town in Zeeland, Holland, to New Amsterdam, to New York, in something like, the still first half of the 17th century, so in the 1600s. And the family has stayed in New York with, of course, a lot of detours for almost its entire history. I don't know that I can think of any member of the family who is still living in New York, but the Roosevelts, which is what it was anglicized to be, were business people, nothing dramatic that I've discovered in my own research. Until they entered the world of politics with my great uncle Theodore, and he was a member of the New York State Assembly, and Assistant Secretary of the Navy. I have a feeling he was also mayor of New York at one point, but obviously most known, well, really in two domains. One as a writer, that he was a terrific writer on a range of subjects, but most of them relating to his love of the outdoors and hunting. But particularly, of course, as president. And he obviously, I didn't know him. My mother was the first child and only daughter of Eleanor and Franklin, and had four brothers who succeeded her in their birth. My mother's name was Anna Eleanor. A long list of Anna Eleanors that went back, I think, to my grandmother's mother.
On your mother's side?
On my mother's side.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still being created. So that's my mother's side of the family. I could go on, but my father was a self-taught newspaper man, a self-taught reporter.
And his name?
John Bodiger.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're his namesake.
I am his namesake, with the exception of the fact that he didn't overwhelmingly trust himself to be a good father. And it was he that insisted I have a middle name, which naturally was Roosevelt. But I don't know what gave him that persuasion, because he was a good father. He wasn't a lot with us, and that I felt as a significant absence in my life. He left when I was 3 for the Army, after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the Army until 44, and during that time, my grandfather, the Roosevelt grandfather, called his daughter and said, "Sis," which is what he called my mother, "why don't you and Johnny come and live with me in the White House?" And nothing could have pleased her more. She was, you know, I think the men in her life, she had 3 husbands in succession, I think always were somewhat overwhelmed by the Roosevelt family.
Mm-hmm.
And but she was a really gifted person. A little too early in the kind of generational succession to have a profession of her own, but she became in the 1930s. And my parents were married in January of 35, and in the 30s, my father, who had started as a self-taught journalist, early 30s, wrote an account for the Chicago Tribune, solid Republican newspaper. My father didn't really have politics. He grew up in the Middle West and never paid much attention to politics, but he was intrigued, not by my mother, whom he didn't know yet, but he wrote a series of stories about the gangland slaying of one of his colleagues, another reporter on the Tribune. And it turned into a book called Jake Lingle. Jake Lingle was the name of the reporter who was killed. And Colonel McCormick, who was the czar of the newspaper, said, "John, you've," said to my father, "John, you've you've written such an interesting piece. I'd like to offer you whatever job at the Tribune you would like. So this was 1932. He said, my father said, well, truthfully, I would like to follow the campaign for the presidency of this fascinating governor of the state of New York, Franklin Roosevelt. And it was on the campaign train in 1932, during the campaign, that my mother and father met, fell in love, were kissing between cars. Had this occurred in a less, well, had this occurred in a more current environment, and had he not been one of the press himself, it could have changed the course of history, because FDR would have faced the first scandal of his career. But he didn't. My father learned to be a Democrat. It wasn't the problem for him. They lived in Washington, of course, for a few years after they were married in January 35. And then he was offered the job of publisher of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which was one of Seattle's two daily papers. It was owned by William Randolph Hearst, so it was typically a conservative paper. He'd never, to my knowledge, Hearst had never offered editorial freedom to any other publisher of his paper. My father insisted upon editorial freedom, and Hearst knew what he was getting, but he cared more about bringing a paper that was in the red into the black. So he agreed, and my parents became publisher in my father's case, my mother an editor first of the what was in those days called the women's pages of the newspaper, and later became kind of an omnibus social part of the paper. And I grew up on an island called Mercer Island, which is of course still there, but it's become a suburb. In those years, it was pretty wild land.
Yes, I know those islands. You take a ferry there, that's the only way.
Yes, well, there was a pontoon bridge between Seattle and Mercer Island.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Yes, beautiful.
Beautiful, and away from what Seattle, I think, at that time was a very different city, of course.
Yes.
But natural beauty.
Mm.
So you grew up surrounded by the water and trees and ocean spray. And
all of that, yes. My father had a little cabin cruiser that he called the News Hawk. And we traveled through Lake Washington and into Puget Sound. They had a small number, but of dear friends. And I grew up knowing them. I didn't know the neighbors very well because we were accompanied by Secret Service agents.
At all times.
At all times.
Yes.
I can still see, I can remember their names, Hazen and Carmody. I can't remember yes. One of them was George, but I don't remember which one. And they would patrol the grounds. And so I grew up with a little sense of endangerment because of their presence. I knew they were there to protect us. I didn't know from what or whom. But I felt secure in that family. My mother's first marriage to an otherwise undistinguished stockbroker ended in divorce, but before it did, she had two older children. So I have a half-brother who's no longer living.
And his name was?
Curtis Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. It was Curtis Dall, D-A-L-L. That was the name of his father. It became, so my brother's name started as Curtis Dall. When my mother and Curtis Sr. divorced and my parents were married, it became Curtis Bodiger.
Mm-hmm.
And when my parents divorced, which is another story, he didn't know where to go with a name. And the only thing he could, the only name that he'd grown up with was Roosevelt.
How old was he with the second divorce, your older brother?
He was a young adult, because I remember him as, particularly in the pictures in the White House, as in a sort of military school uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And he took the name Curtis Roosevelt at some cost, because his uncles, my mother's brothers, felt he wasn't entitled to it.
Let's talk, what are your mother's, okay, your mother's name is Anna. Right, Anna. And your uncle's names were from oldest to youngest?
From oldest to youngest. James, Jimmy, who was a Marine in the war. Elliot, Franklin Jr., and John.
And those boys felt that the name had to be, there was some kind of...
Oh, it had to be deeply inscribed, if not tattooed.
Not very helpful for a fellow who's not feeling exactly here nor there.
Absolutely, right.
Oh,
yes.
Ouch.
Yes.
And then your other brother, you have one older...
No, I have one. Oh. My Curtis died a couple of years ago, living in France. And,
but he did settle with Roosevelt at the end.
He did. He did. Yes. And his widow still bears the name. But my mother's first child was one of the Anna Eleanors.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And in their White House years, in the early and middle 30s, they lived in the White House. And they were known to the public as Sisty and Buzzy.
Oh, my goodness. Sisty and Buzzy.
Sisty and Buzzy. And I don't think either one of them quite lived it down. I still call my sister Sis.
Yes.
Although her name is Ellie.
So you had the two older half-siblings.
Yes.
And then there's you.
Yes.
The namesake of your father.
Yes.
And John. And then you have, who else? Who's after you?
Well, four sons. No, sorry. My daughter would perk up her ears. Three sons and a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
They're now adults. And wonderful adults.
And these are your children?
These are my children.
Yeah. But with your mother, the children she had, in total, she had...
She had three.
Three. Oh, three in total.
Right.
Somehow I thought there were more.
No.
And then you've had four. So you've done your part to keep the population up.
Right, right.
And your children's name are?
My children's name, starting with the eldest, are Adam, whom we named... My wife and I named Adam because... we were at that point in the mood to create a new enterprise, a new family.
So not it's biblical.
Not burdened with parental presence, and I called the one person I knew in my father's family was his brother Bill, and I called Uncle Bill, and I said, "Guess what, Uncle Bill? We've just had a son. And we've named him Adam." And Bill said, "Oh, after your grandfather, Adam, and his father, Adam." I had no idea that I had a grandfather and a great-grandfather named Adam
You
Boniger.
Just can't get away from the family name.
Yeah.
So you've got Adam.
So Adam Sarah, S-A-R-A, really named in honor of or imitation of my grandfather's mother, Sarah Delano Roosevelt.
Right, the infamous mother of the president.
That's right, right.
Yes.
I think she got that air of infamy through being a powerful patrician presence, not because she was in any sense cruel to her progeny or in general to others. She was a thoughtful and kind person.
Yes, yes. Interesting how that kind of influence, when it's powerful, can be twisted.
Yes, it's true.
And then you have, okay, so you have Adam and Sarah.
Adam and Sarah, and the third, Joshua.
Mm-hmm.
I think we weren't consciously looking for a name from the Torah and a name from the New Testament, but that's what we ended up with.
So who in the family is named Joshua? Or is this a first time?
Joshua lives in Ashland, Oregon, huh? And is a rabbi.
Oh, I Googled your name and saw him and thought it can't possibly
it
be
is.
Part of the family. Your
yes.
son's a rabbi.
He's a congregational rabbi in Ashland.
Mazel tov.
Oh, thank you. He just also finished a Master of Fine Arts in poetry in Oregon, and I think his hope is to sort of gradually move away from the sort of 24/7 demands mm-hmm. of a congregational rabbi mm-hmm. and become a teacher of poetry and an advisor to Jewish students.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's a long tradition of that in the Jewish religion. That shouldn't be too hard to.
Yes.
And then my
fourth child, the New Testament child, was Paul. Not Paul of Tarsus, but Paul Boniger, and Paul lives in Petaluma, not far from here. Is not married. But is a designer of enormously talented designer of the interiors of homes and furniture.
Mm.
And he also, like Joshua, with his MFA in poetry, is in the midst of one of these increasingly common mid-career changes of career that he's also an artist of I think great talent in charcoal and in oil, and I encouraged him not quite a year ago to have a show. He had a show in Sebastopol. He sold six of his pieces. I don't think it's going to change his profession, but I think he sees it as a kind of co-profession.
So before we move on to when you grew up in your school and more about your family and what brought you to Mill Valley, let us not forget the co-creator of this lovely family, and that is your wife.
Yes.
And her name.
Yes. Actually, I have to admit, I have had four.
Oh, my.
So Adam and Sarah were born of the same mother, my first wife, and Joshua and Paul were born of the same mother, but another person. That's why I said to the third of my ex-wives the other day. She reminded me that I had said, you know, I'm a better friend than a husband.
Mm-hmm.
And she said to herself, I think I can change that. And I think, sadly, she didn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, Let us go back, because, you know, and when you study the Roosevelt family and you learn about the Roosevelt family, there is, always included in the story is the interpersonal dynamics between the push and pull of the public life, the private life, the relationships found and lost, the love, the heartbreak, the challenge, everything.
Yeah.
You have such a family history. Mm. In particular, I think about your grandmother, Eleanor, and the lonely childhood that you, I didn't know her, of course. I remember reading about her in college many years ago and being struck by her childhood, which included loss of her parents and a certain sense of alienation. And then Franklin Roosevelt, who had the most unusual, wonderful relationship with his mother, Sarah.
Yes.
And then everything in between. And then the life you lead when you're in the public eye, you know, your parents were as glamorous, or your grandparents were as glamorous and as known everywhere in the world. Your grandfather had, four terms, died in his fourth term, being in the public eye. Everyone watched your grandmother basically grow up with starting with the presidency and politics and then become somebody, really, that she hadn't been young. And there's all these evolutions, and it's all fueled by heart and it seems to me, if I can be so arrogant as to say, fueled by heart, ambition, and also a sense of duty.
Yes, yes. In both cases, I think the word that my grandmother would be most comfortable in using in expressing her own fundamental commitment was to be useful. It seemed like a plain word, but her determination was to really contribute to improving the quality of the lives of those who were either too poor or who needed assistance. She was a founder of a community, Arthurdale. She was a strong civil rights supporter. I traveled with her in Europe quite a lot. I remember one incident in which I was at a conference in Berlin.
What year was this?
This was, maybe 1960, when I graduated from college. And I was at a conference on the United Nations in Berlin. And I had a call from my grandmother, who said, "Johnny, I'm having lunch tomorrow in Brussels with Harry Belafonte, and I'd like you to be there." And I said my name for her, all of our names for her, was grand-mère. She learned French before she learned English. And I said, "Grand-mère, I'm in the middle of a conference in Berlin. I have any idea how to get myself out tomorrow." And she said, "I really want you to be there."
I guess you couldn't really say no to someone like
so
her.
So I could not say no. And I managed to find an ancient DC-3, a relic of World War II, that had been bought by Polish Airlines and was decked out in a kind of Victorian tassel kind of decoration.
Gaudy.
And it got me to Brussels, but there was fog. And the plane was descending, and all of a sudden I'd look out the window and I would see telephone poles flashing by. So suddenly we would turn up. It turned out that the Polish pilot spoke neither English nor French, which were the sort of the universal languages of people trying to talk airplanes and into it. You couldn't do it in those days all by radar.
No.
But he did land successfully.
You're like, what? I'm going to die.
I did have lunch with my grandmother and Harry Belafonte, which I loved.
Wow. So in your life, you're born in 1939, correct? Mm-hmm. So, and at what point do you become aware that you're born into really an American royal family, in a sense, that you are, or the people that you know as every day are not like most parents to the most of your childhood friends?
I think it happened gradually that my grandfather came for a few visits to Seattle when he was campaigning, mm-hmm. mostly. My grandmother came more frequently. That one of my treasured pictures is of my grandfather, my grandmother holding her daughter's hand, my mother's hand, when she was giving birth to me.
Oh, that's sweet.
It really was.
Because back then, often women were alone in a birthing room under the care of a physician. That kind of familiarity would necessarily have happened.
My grandmother understood that, and she tried. I don't know if she really was at every birth of every grandchild, but she really believed in it.
Do you think that her childhood disappointments or her loneliness was a driving force in her desire to attend to the concerns and the ills of others? Or is this just a family trait?
That's an interesting thought. I think that she grew up without a mother who loved her deeply. And a mother who called her granny because she acted, in her mother's observation, like an old person.
So she was one of those old souls, very young.
One of those old souls, very young. But her commitment to the poor, that her coming into her own as an independent person in her adult life, I think the people who most influenced her were Louis Howe, who was one of my grandfather's closest colleagues, assistants, and Harry Hopkins, who lived in the White House and undertook various wartime missions for FDR, and she listened to them. She had initially, when she was a young adult, she had a very squeaky voice, and not one that made for easy public service. But they coached her, and she came to speak in public with an eloquence that astonished me.
Almost as a British sort of a voice.
Yes. Well, she went to school at Allenswood, a British public, that is, private school, and the headmistress of Allenswood, Marie Souvestre, was French and took her on several trips and taught her, really well before Louis Howe and Harry Hopkins, to be her own person. And she grew up, I think, even before the White House years, to be an independent human being. Their relationship, what could I say about Franklin and Eleanor's relationship that hasn't already been said? Nothing. But they were close without being intimate. She traveled a lot during the war for the Red Cross. During the years that my mother and I lived in the White House, she was mostly gone. So I didn't come to know my grandmother intimately until...
How old were you when you were when you were living in the White House as a child? From what age?
From age 3 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
during all war years until my grandfather died.
And your other siblings with you?
No, my older siblings were away at boarding school most of the time. So they weren't there. I was the only child living in the White House during World War II. And it was a mix of a gifted time. You know, I could command the White House theater to be a little Cecil B. DeMille of, you know, show cartoons as much as I wished. I could walk or march with the White House guards. I could swim in the White House pool with my grandfather. He would take me up on his lap to read the funny papers in the early morning. It was in all of those senses a gift, but it was also a time of loneliness because I was the only child there.
They didn't bring children in? There were no employees with children?
No. Well, there may have been, but they didn't live in the White House. The employees that helped to care for me didn't bring their spouses with them. So I had the entire third floor of the White House, I and my caretakers, my nurses, to myself. And I remember a picture of a photograph of myself during those years standing probably 5 years old in a fountain that was empty of water. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me to express the sort of the shadow side of those years in the White House. When my grandfather died, I heard it. I had a simple, like, staphylococcus infection. But in those days, penicillin had just been invented because of the war. And so it was chancy. And oddly enough, when FDR went to Warm Springs, he'd been accompanied to Yalta, the last of his wartime conferences, by my mother. And when he returned, he went to restore himself at his sort of second home in Warm Springs, Georgia, mm-hmm. which he established as a recuperative center for those with polio, mm-hmm. as he had. Everyone expected him to return, restored. But I remember being in the Naval Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland.
And you yourself sick. Yep, you're sick in the Naval Hospital.
I'm sick in the Naval Hospital in Bethesda. My grandfather's supposedly recuperating. My grandmother and my mother did not accompany him to Warm Springs because the family was more worried about me than they were about him. And I heard on the radio that beside my bed in the hospital that my grandfather had died. And the talk was of the president. And I couldn't, my name for him was Papa. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't quite identify. Maybe I wouldn't identify that announcement with him. So it wasn't until later in that day that I learned from my mother that indeed it was my grandfather who had died. And
so interesting to hear you tell the story, because I'm looking at you and your eyes, I mean, there really is a family resemblance.
Is there?
Yes, there really is.
Well, probably also on the Bodiger side, but
so you are living. Now your grandfather dies, and that will be the last time any president will have four terms. The law changed after that.
His tenure, I think, was responsible for the constitutional amendment that limited a president to two successive terms.
Did people think he just basically worked himself to death? Or was
Yes. He was 63 when he died. I mean, much younger than I am now. And I think he was as much a casualty of the war as anyone who died at Normandy or elsewhere in the war.
Were you able to perceive at that young age the burden of the presidency and the political situation?
No.
Did you have any idea at all what had been going on? Did you have family discussions at the dinner table of politics?
Always discussions of politics at the dinner table. The dinner table around a Roosevelt dinner table was something of a raucous affair. I remember at one point, probably it was Thanksgiving, because it could have been Christmas. My grandfather was carving a turkey, and he was at one end of this long table. I was at the other end. And he said, "Johnny, I think I remember you would prefer a drumstick." And I said, "Yes, Papa." And he said, "Okay, here it comes." Now, he had a butler standing right next to him with a silver tray, but he flipped it the length of the table. And, I mean, his aim was perfect. I lifted a linen napkin and managed to catch it. But that's something of the fun, but also the seriousness of political discussion around a White House dinner table.
Did you feel growing up that it was going to be a requirement of you to participate in the public way? Or were you? Did you integrate the family ethic of serving through your grandmother's efforts and your grandfather's?
Well, it's a good question. There were two of us in my generation who were identified within the family. God knows how that happened, as potentially holders of public office. I was one. My cousin Frank, who was FDR the third, who's a year older than I, was the second, and we both chose to be academics. So it never occurred to me, really. I mean, I was involved in public affairs, like the United Nations Association that I served with my grandmother, but I was never tempted by public office. I think I saw too much of the distressed impact of public life on the family life of those in positions of public service.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it was, of course, very hard for my father, but I think in her own way, for all of her accomplishments, it was hard also for my mother.
Mm-hmm.
and her brothers. So in any event, I became a psychologist.
So where did you end up going to college?
I went to Amherst College, which, you know, in those days, it was very unplanned. I think I went to Amherst College because we were invited to lunch by the president of the college.
We being, who's we?
We being my mother and by then my stepfather.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pleased that the president of the college would invite us. So you can tell how little that being a Roosevelt had worn off on me. Well, I say that, and yet, it's only half true that my college years at Amherst were full of a sense that much was expected of me, and that that I would be looked at by my professors as a Roosevelt and needed to meet, you know, an impossible standard. So the first year, I remember going home even early in the first year for Thanksgiving, and my mother was rubbing my back as I was going to sleep. And I said, "Mommy, I really am having a hard time this year. I think I'm going to join the Army."
Oh. Oh, my. Oops. And just what a mother wants to hear.
She said, gently enough but firmly, she said, "I don't think that's a very good idea. I think if you return to Amherst, you'll do just fine."
Do you think she made a call?
I think she made a call. I think she knew what she was talking about, because it's true that when I went home, or when I came back to college, I let go of a lot of those expectations that I imagined other people had, mm-hmm. and became a good student.
You know, I'm smiling thinking of your mother rubbing your back. For those that don't see you, as I do, you're really tall. You're a big boy. I'm sure you were a big boy back then, too.
I was already a big boy, yeah.
So yes. She's talking to her big boy.
Yes.
And I'm sure you would have made a very fine-looking soldier, but she was.
I might have.
She would have not wanted that. Mm-hmm. So you went to Amherst, and so tell me a little bit more, because we're going to include, too, I know you have to get going, but we want to include what brought you here to Mill Valley and your experiences here in Mill Valley as well. But your life is so very interesting. And you have such an interesting, you on your own, your accomplishments as in your professional life are significant. So tell me a little bit more about how it went for you. You went to Amherst, you studied.
I went to Amherst, and I was invited as a callow, young faculty member to occupy it wasn't yet tenured, but it was a tenured track position. And in the middle of that first year, I got wind through a classmate of mine of that the consortium of then four colleges, Smith College, Mount Holyoke College, Amherst College, and the University of Massachusetts, that consortium was going to add a new college. I think it had as much to do with their not wanting to innovate too much themselves. And I was excited by that prospect. Turned out to be named Hampshire College, after Hampshire County, but it was a remarkably innovative college, and I was its first faculty member.
And how old were you?
I was in my maybe mid to late 20s.
So we're talking 39, 49, 59. This is in the early 60s.
Yeah. It was in the late 50s and early 60s. We opened in 1960, and Hampshire is, that was a very yeasty time in the creation of all kinds of things.
Yeasty,
you know.
I like that way to describe it, a very yeasty time.
Yes.
I know exactly what you're saying.
Yes, and of all of the experiments in higher education that were undertaken during that time, Hampshire is the only one that not only still stands, but is maintained its experimenting character. So it's a college in which students have a much greater role in determining the nature of their exploration, their focus, what other colleges would call their major.
So you had studied psychology. You're a psychologist now,
yes,
by trade.
Yes.
Did you practice psychology?
Only marginally. I was really a teaching psychologist. I had a small practice, but predominantly, I was a teaching psychologist, and my mentors, who really shaped my life as a psychologist, were a couple, Eric and Joan Erickson. Eric was, when he was teaching at the University of California.
Eric Erickson.
Yes. Eric really wrote the book on human development, mm-hmm. especially human development as a whole life cycle phenomenon. Mm-hmm. From his students at Harvard used to call his course "From Womb to Tomb."
So at this point in your life, and actually you're perched right now in the 60s at a moment where there's now, it's after World War II, and mm-hmm. social change, you can hear the drumbeats in the distance, mm-hmm. and you're in a more progressive environment, and you've got a lens in which to view the world. You're obviously a thoughtful person, introspective too, it appears. Mm-hmm. And did you ever, at that point in your adulthood, turn the lens in on yourself and your family experiences and view your family history and the impact that your family had had on the nation in a different eye?
I do. I think that's been a slow but continuous part of my life. It's still there. Whenever I can manage to meet one of my favorite cousins, like Frank, and I will do so. We stay in touch. My wife and I, this is my last wife, were fellow psychologists at this brilliant healing community in Norway, north, slightly west of Oslo. And both of us had come as consultants to Norway prior to that time, but we kept coming back to this place, which was called Modumbad. Modumbad in Norwegian is the baths at Modum. Mm-hmm. And because in the 19th century, yes. it was a spa.
Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of spas because there was a lot of TB.
Yeah, yeah,
and
true.
Other illnesses.
Right.
Right.
But in 1957, it was bought by two psychiatrists who turned it into I think the most extraordinary healing community that I've ever known. That its centerpiece was a hospital, which one would call a mental hospital, but it bore so little resemblance to the hospitals in which I was trained in this country. No locked wards. We had some limits because of that on the kind of patients we would accept. But we also, in addition to patients who were hospitalized, we had little pods, little mini communities on the campus that served as antidotes to burnout of people in particular professions, physicians, nurses, pastors, so it was not simply a mental hospital, even in the wonderful sense in which that hospital was, but it was, that's why I call it a healing community rather than just a hospital. Mm-hmm. And my wife was, we fit it perfectly because my wife's bias, Lee. Mm-hmm. Lee, when we met, was a member of the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and I was still at Hampshire College, and we corresponded for at least a month before by that time I gained a little wisdom about how you do adult relationships. And
with three behind you?
With three behind me, that's right. So we loved going because her passion was research. Mm-hmm. She really wanted to understand what makes psychotherapy tick. What makes it succeed and what makes it fail? Mm. That was her passion. And so she became the head of the Research Institute, which is still probably one of the leading institutes of research in psychology in the world. I continue to read, because I made very close Norwegian friends, I continue to read the manuscripts of the doctors the clinicians who were responsible in the hospital or in one of those pods, it's terrific research. What I do is something that Lee called English washing, that at some point you may publish initially in a Norwegian journal. But in order to have your work seen, you really need to publish in an internationally known journal in the field. And there, the quality, I mean, Norwegians are taught to teach English, to learn English when they're probably starting when they're 2 or 3 years old. So they're excellent speakers of English, but they, you know, they don't really have the kind of polish that, so
the nuance.
So Lee called it English washing, and I still do.
Mm-hmm. So interesting, because your family, there's so much of the social ills that your grandmother attended to, and your mm-hmm. grandfather with the New Deal and the ways that he could help to restore the health of a nation, mm. and you are on an individual basis,
yes.
doing a different kind of healing.
Much more so, yes. Yes, it's true.
Interesting. Well, what brought you, now you've lived in Norway, you've grown up in Hyde Park and the White House and Seattle.
Yes.
And all these places, but we are sitting in the library in Mill Valley.
That's right.
How in the world did you come to Mill Valley?
Oh, it's both a sad story and with a wonderful ending, that Lee on a speaking tour, which we were accustomed to make together and individually, she was on a speaking tour in the United States, and she suddenly developed symptoms in which she could no longer speak.
Mm. That is something that happens with a particular condition.
Yeah.
You lose the ability to speak, use your voice well.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So she learned, I said, get a second opinion. We're on a transcontinental telephone. Please get a second opinion, because the first opinion was ALS. And
I suspect the second opinion, too.
It was confirmed by the second opinion. Mm-hmm. So I just put whatever I could find in the suitcase and came to join her. I've since gone back to Modenbad two or three, maybe more times, and gathered more of my belongings, our belongings. But when Lee died...
How long did she last?
She lasted for 3 years.
3 to 5 years, I think, is the projected
yeah.
survival rate once you've been diagnosed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it must have been pretty aggressive.
It is a vicious disease. Mm-hmm. And she was hospitalized in Cambridge, where we had a home nearby in Dedham, Massachusetts. And when she was near death, my sons and I gathered in the living room of that home and confronted the question of where should I go when she dies. And one of my sons, the youngest, Paul, had visited the mother of a friend, maybe the grandmother of a friend, at the Redwoods. This, you know, I had no idea what the Redwoods was. I did, by that time, know something about living in a community in Norway. But Paul said, I remember, Dad, you've been teaching about community for over 20 years, and you've only just scratched the surface of understanding what you were teaching about.
Time for your field study class.
Right. So they suggested the Redwoods, and
so
I asked.
So they took a family vote and.
Right. Both of them.
But what, is anybody living in the vicinity? I mean.
Well, at that point, let's see. At that point, I think all of my family, all of my four children, were living as adults in the Pacific Northwest, as they still do. Mm-hmm. So one of the joys and reasons that I accepted with such alacrity was that I could be close. I mean, we had lived in Seattle, you know, in Lake Washington, mm-hmm. Mercer Island, when I was a child, and now all of a sudden I can live as a father and grandfather and now great-grandfather with my children and their children and their children in Mill Valley.
Like Mercer, only with way better weather.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
So you came, did you preview the Redwoods before you came?
No,
you just
jumped. I asked Paul to take some pictures. Mm-hmm. But you don't learn a lot from pictures. So
what year did you come? You came as a single man with a suitcase.
I came 7 years ago with a couple of suitcases.
And so you're in your early 70s then.
Yes, yes.
You're young.
And I was young for the Redwoods.
Yes.
I mean, whose average age has climbed over the years, but I think it's now in the mid to late 80s. So I'm as
female dominant too.
And female dominant. Yes. Yes.
So you walked into your new home. Did you feel like you were just entering Amherst for the first year?
No. No. I felt like a stranger initially.
You're a stranger in a strange land.
And
you're heartsick.
Yeah.
And I imagine quite exhausted after the last 3 years.
Yes, exactly.
Psychologically and physically.
Yes. Yes.
So maybe you were in need of a little recuperation yourself.
I think that's right. I did go back. When Lee died, Lee had two children from an earlier marriage, and I stayed in close touch with them as long as I could. But her daughter, who would have been the one to organize a memorial service, was not, for a variety of reasons, able to do so. And I was sorry about that, but I was living on the West Coast, and if Lee had a memorial service, it would be around Cambridge, where she had spent most of her adult life. So Modenbad, this wonderful healing community in Norway, said, well, we would love to have a memorial service for your wife, and we'll combine it with a seminar on the character and quality of her work. So it was beautifully done, and both dimensions, such a wonderful learning experience. But in a way, it wasn't. Burial. It was bringing to a conclusion a period of my life, and so when I came west, when I came to Mill Valley, when I came to the Redwoods, it was with a relatively a sense of freedom, and I find that in some ways I'm practicing a lot of what I practiced when I was teaching, that I don't have a psychological practice anymore, but I do teach courses at the Redwoods, and of in which the redwoods is rich. I have a lot of really good friends, and that's made a huge difference.
You know, it's here in Mill Valley and in Marin County, the Roosevelt family is very important, of course, indirectly, in that we have Muir Woods because of Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes, and there's a grove at Muir Woods that's named in honor of Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And as I recall, if I get my history right, that Teddy lost his beloved mother and wife the same day.
That's right.
And ill, in, you know, heartsick and physically unwell, he went west to work on the cattle ranch, I guess, and regained his health. And because of that experience, he created the Antiquities Act.
Yes.
Which would be the beginning of the park system as we know it, where you take beautiful, because he knew the value of, in his own, because he, as I understand from the Ken Burns show, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, Teddy Roosevelt had always had health issues, but being outside and working outside, even after this gutting loss, had strengthened him, so he knew the value of the outdoor and the wilderness.
Absolutely.
And it was William Kent, who lived here and owned the property where Muir Woods, who wrote the letter to Teddy Roosevelt, fearful that the old redwood grove would be taken
as commercial property. Really, I didn't know that.
Well, it was going to be, they were going to access the water potentially to create a dam and also take the trees down to rebuild the city had burned in 1906.
Wow.
And it was Teddy Roosevelt who accepted the land as a gift and created the first park for living things ever in the United States. So interesting, here it is, you come from a sense of loss and recovery and come to the West.
Yes.
In this beautiful natural world. I'm interviewing you, I'm looking out to the redwood trees outside the window of the library.
Mm.
So you have a very important family presence here in Mill Valley.
Well, you know, I came to the Redwoods with a feeling that maybe I can slip in without anybody really taking note of the fact that I was a Roosevelt, because my name is John Boddicker. The fact that my middle name started with an R.
Yeah. I notice it's always the initial.
It's always the initial.
Yes.
But the Redwoods, the generation of the Redwoods, was the generation that knew the Roosevelts better than anybody else.
there have been people that may have been reading about the turkey being flung across the table.
Who
knows what else? Right.
Although I think that was a private dinner.
And also we have here in our town evidence of the New Deal.
That's true, yes.
Shall we talk about the Living New Deal?
Sure. The Living New Deal is a wonderful organization. It was started by two professors of geography at UC Berkeley as an organization that would collect New Deal sites, New Deal buildings, camps of the Civilian Conservation Corps, the website of the Living New Deal, probably called livingnewdeal.org, is testimony to its success. I mean, it's limited itself, as it needs to the United States, but it has cataloged and illustrated more, first in San Francisco, then in New York, and then through the country. Every building made by the Works Progress Administration, by any of the New Deal agencies, they asked me to join the board of the Living New, the advisory board of the Living New Deal, which I was happy to do.
So they knew you were here.
They did know I was here, yes. Yes, right.
They found you.
I think I was easier to find than I had imagined.
So now you're a part, you know, we've got, Gray's going to be speaking on the first Wednesday, the Mill Valley Historical Society's first Wednesday in September, and I hope you will come.
Thank you.
Here in Mill Valley, we have the Cushing Theater. Mm. We have Park School, part of Tam High. These are all buildings. I know the reinforcement on Mount Tam to the CCC of creeks and streams.
Yes.
There's a great influence of the workers from the CCC, from the original New Deal, which was your grandfather.
Yes, yes.
What do you think, if maybe this is a hypothetical question, of course, but how do you think your grandfather would see the state of affairs socially right now? And
socially or
politically?
Politically.
Politically.
He'd be appalled. I mean, that goes without saying about the federal government presided over by Donald Trump. It sounds like maybe too much family, but I as a scholar as much as a grandson, I regard Franklin Roosevelt as one of the three or four most accomplished presidents in our history. And he would, were he, and as you say, it's hypothetical, but were he working in the world of politics, I think he would do his best to strengthen the spine and the quality of thought and commitment of the Democratic Party. I don't know that he would be particularly pleased with the Democrats we've just elected to the Congress, because he was not a middle of the roader. He was a genuine progressive. He modeled his career on his cousin Teddy. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Governor of New York, and it was as if he occupied at least a significant number of the posts before he ran for president that his cousin Theodore had.
And, so he was a trained politician.
Yes, yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you ever have people come up to you, knowing you are who you are, and start railing about politics? Is this like...
Rarely.
Rarely?
Rarely. I do have, my friends at the Redwoods know that I am a Roosevelt, and so I will pass one who is being wheeled in a wheelchair by a member of the staff, and I could hear him in back telling the member of the staff, "Do you know that's the grandson of President Franklin Roosevelt?" So I take it now in course. It doesn't have any of the ambivalence that I felt when I was a freshman in college.
Yes. I guess I suppose to come to peace with coming from a family like yours, you can have a choice to feel inadequate, or you can be just very proud.
That's a very thoughtful way of putting it. Yes.
You talked about your community at the Redwoods, which fascinates me, by the way. Can you, before we end this interview, can you tell me a little bit about what it is for you to live in community at Redwoods? What does that mean practically?
It means practically that although each of us at the Redwoods has a small apartment, that each apartment looks out on greensward. It could be a view of Mount Tam. In my case, it's on a beautiful courtyard into which
Oh, you're looking at the inner courtyard?
I'm looking at the inner courtyard, but it's full of birch and redwoods and maple trees.
Oh, that courtyard is awfully nice.
It's beautiful.
Yes.
And it's where, when it rains, which it does too little in Mill Valley, it's where the egrets come to feed and to get out of the wind. So the community is very warm and actually intellectually it includes some very impressive people. Retired professors from Stanford, from UC Berkeley, people who have come from longer distances than I would imagine, except I came from a relatively long distance myself.
You're counting Norway. So you feel like you're among a community of individuals that you can express your academic interests and have fulfilling conversations?
I do, yes.
Are you surprised by that?
Well, I think I was initially surprised by that there were a couple of groups whose titles suggest something about their content. One called Searching for Meaning, another called Interspiritual Inquiry, that reflect my interest not only as a clinical psychologist or developmental psychologist, I was trained in both, but my interest in the relationship between the psyche, maybe is more narrowly confined, and the spiritual life of those, in my case, who are my colleagues and friends at the Redwoods. So it's of all of the places I could, who knows where else I would have ended up, but if I was living by myself in a little apartment somewhere, I would lack all that richness of companionship. And I've enjoyed it for 7 years now. I'm planning to continue.
So you started out in the White House and you're ending up in the Redwoods. Now I'm going to ask you, and this is maybe an unfair question, but how's the food compared to each other?
Actually, it's not a bad question because the food at the Redwoods is probably a more balanced diet, deliberately to sustain the health of a relatively elderly population. The food of the White House was during my years at the White House, the cook was named Mrs. Nesbitt, and this is published information, so it's no surprise. And Mrs. Nesbitt was a cranky lady who would make whatever she was inclined to make, and she would consult with my grandmother or my grandfather, but neither of them had a primary interest in food. I mean, my grandfather loved to carve, as that story.
Carve and throw,
right. My grandmother really couldn't be less interested. She could make, actually, my grandfather could make one thing, cook one thing, Brussels sprouts.
Oh, yum.
And my grandmother could make one thing, scrambled eggs.
Not a good mix, the two of them.
No, not a good mix.
Oh, my.
But probably better than Mrs. Nesbitt.
Finally, as we're getting ready to close this up, I have to ask you, you've met so many people in the course of your life, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me a few names of people that in particular really left an impact in your life for you, inspired you, somehow put you on course in your life? Or...
Oh, well, I think I would have to... There are many, including my teachers at Amherst College, some of them. But I think really predominantly, I think of the two most publicly known and remembered of the Kennedy brothers, John and Bobby. Robert Frost, whom John Kennedy asked to prepare and read a poem at Kennedy's inauguration. And it was a touching moment because Frost, who was elderly by then, couldn't see the manuscript. So this president about to be inaugurated stood and held his hat, a big top hat, between Robert Frost's podium and the sun, so that Frost could read the poem. So those two, there were other presidents whom I met didn't, as you would imagine, find as engaging when President Reagan was in office. I had, at that point, was organizing family reunions because my grandmother had died some years before, so he invited our whole clan to the White House for lunch, I don't know that it was a mistake for him, but it certainly had a deleterious effect on my behavior. He drew me aside and said, "If your grandfather were still here in this White House as president, he would be doing just what I'm doing."
Oh my.
And I had to really, I was so taken aback that I found politely another person to talk with, but at the luncheon, I was still sweating and...
Simmering, more like.
Simmering, but also sweating because my glasses, which I was wearing then, lost a lens into the cream of cauliflower soup. And you don't clean a lens with a linen napkin from the White House. So I said goodbye to the president and Mrs. Reagan with one lens in and one lens out. And I somehow felt as if that was my small symbol of
resist.
Of reserve.
Interesting. Actually, it's an interesting metaphor, too.
Yeah, yeah. I worked another man who was very influential in my life. I served as his research assistant, was the extraordinary American historian Henry Steele Commager, who was teaching at Amherst when I was a student. And I worked with him. In fact, I sat at a social event, between a dinner probably, between Robert Frost and Henry Steele Commager, and Commager was a sort of fire plug of a man, you know, who stood about 5 feet tall, and the thing I remember most about him actually is not his his influential teaching, but the fact that he used to beat me at ping pong so reliably. He would give me 18 points out of 21, and he would still beat me.
Ouch.
He just covered that court.
How about a moment at the Redwoods? Can you give me a day in your life or a moment that really sums up your experience in the Redwoods? Include people or things and names quality of light or whatever you want, but give us a little bit of your world in the Redwoods.
Oh.
Not necessarily with a lens in the soup, although
yes.
That would be okay.
Yes. Well, I have a close friend at the Redwoods who, though her name is Jimmy, she is a woman, and she grew up in Texas, in East Texas, Southeast Texas, and she retains so much of the culture in which she grew, and actually told me things about my grandfather that I didn't know. A day would be sprinkled with meetings of one group or another, which I've illustrated. There would be a lot of time to write because I'm in the midst of revising a book that I wrote a biography of my parents' lives in the 1970s, after they both had died. And the one critic, it was favorably reviewed and sold enough to persuade W.W. Norton that they would like me to do something more. What I'm doing now, what the one critic who said, you know, something's missing here. He was a man named Jeffrey Wolfe, who wrote for the New Republic, and he said, what's missing is the voice of the writer. That after all, it's his parents and their family of whom he's writing. So he notes his own birth and the moves of the family, but he doesn't really speak the experience of his life from 1939, when I was born, to, let's say, 1975, when my mother died. And he was right. So I'm trying to rectify that and have an audience in New York at W.W. Norton to see if they're interested in its republication.
So let's close with that thought. You're Roosevelt. You're part of this amazing family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are in the fabric of the world, of the DNA.
Yes.
You're very much a part of it. How do you see yourself in the family? I mean, it's hard always to see ourselves, I understand, but you're a very important part of your family on many levels. It's not just what you got from your grandmother, your grandfather, your mother, your father, but
true.
What they got from you as well.
Yes, I suppose. I don't imagine them as having received a lot from me except love, which is no small matter. I think now that increasingly I see myself as a member of the community in which I live. And by that I mean not only the Redwoods, but the town and the surround of Mill Valley. Its trails, which you know better than I, but that to hike on the shoulder of Mount Tam is one of my great joys. So I increasingly feel, you know, like an ordinary guy who was blessed with an extraordinary family, and I I love that family and those who have gone and those who remain. But I'm so delighted that all four of my sons live in the Pacific Northwest. But increasingly I find that I'm living my own life. And the Roosevelt portion of it is interior. Occasionally emerges in a lecture that I'd be invited to offer. But mostly I live in the community.
Your own man in a larger clan.
Yes, yes, just so.
Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you so much for sharing these personal stories and these times about your family and your personal life and the adventures you've been on. I'm very glad you came to Mill Valley when you did, although I'm sorry that the conditions had happened.
Yes.
But I'm grateful for the fact that it brought you here and for your continued involvement in our community, in your community.
Mm.
And I one last question for you.
Mm.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to comment on?
Well, not that it's any more important than anything that we've talked about, but one little piece of my life that probably deserves mention is that when I was actually trained at Columbia University as a political scientist before I was trained as a psychologist, and I had only my dissertation to write, and I didn't want to sit around Columbia to do it. So my faculty friends at Columbia said, let's see what place we can find for you on the West Coast, which I think you would love and which I know into which you were born. And they found a faculty position at UC Berkeley, and they found a research position at the Rand Corporation, which at that point was exclusively funded out of Santa Monica by the United States Air Force. When the head of the social science department asked me, what task should we put you to? I said, well, I would need to finish a dissertation on the subject generally of the uses of military force as an instrument of diplomacy, or the efforts to do so, many of them unsuccessful. And he said, well, guess what? We have a basement full of the raw data of the B-52 pilots that were currently bombing the Ho Chi Minh Trail in North Vietnam. We don't know what to do with them. They're highly classified. We'll have to get through even super secret clearance in order to gain access to them. But how'd you like to spend the next few months in the basement of the Rand Corporation? And I said, okay. And I wrote two books about that were written with Air Force money, and that were highly critical of United States policy in Vietnam. And they, of course, being as classified as they weren't available to my unclassified colleagues to read. I could probably get them through the Freedom of Information Act, but by now they'd be, you know, old history. But I enjoyed it. It was a good year. It persuaded me that I didn't have a lifetime of research in the future.
Living in the bowels of UC Berkeley.
That's right.
Not such a bad place to be, so long as you can get some air from time to time.
Right.
Well,
right.
Go Bears. Okay. I think that's pretty much it. I keep feeling like there's one more thing, but maybe we'll... Oh, I know what it is.
Oh.
These classes you offer at the Redwoods, are those open? Are these discussion groups?
Yes, they tend to be discussion groups, and they're predominantly their membership is other residents of the Redwoods, but not exclusively. In fact, I just got a note from an email note from a woman saying, you know, she was apologizing for herself. She said, "I'm 82 years old. You know, I only know the Redwoods by reputation, favorably. But what you have written, which I've seen, descriptive of a seminar that I was sort of co-leading," she said, "I like a lot, and I'd love to come. But I'm not an intellectual. What do you think? I haven't told anybody else about this."
Sweet.
And I wrote her a note saying, "Please come. You would be so welcome." And I hope she does. I'll find out on Tuesday of next week.
Maybe at some point a particular oral historian that you know might be included in one of the discussions or two.
That would be lovely.
Okay, John, well, thank you so much. We'll call this a wrap, and I will see you at the Redwoods.
Good. Thank you.